nice to see you again. Wonderful. So good to see faces I haven't seen for a while. So just to give you a little overview of how our morning is going to work together, we'll start with an arriving meditation, and then I'll offer some thoughts for the morning, and then we will have a longer meditation, and then a break, some announcements, and then a Dharma talk, and certainly plenty of time to talk with each other. All right, so again, welcome, and let's begin right away with an arriving meditation. I want to invite all of us to just find a comfortable posture in your body, feeling how you're sitting or standing, lying down, whatever the posture is of steadiness and presence. Feel the ways the body is connected to the earth, whatever it's touching. Sensing into the breath, coming and going. And holding just enough energy in the back body to keep a bright mind, to keep alert and awake, but allowing the front of the body to soften so there's room to breathe. Strong back, soft front, arriving and settling. And welcoming yourself into practice this morning, this sense of returning, coming back to oneself, to our Sangha together, the good friend that practice is, that is always here welcoming us back. Let's take a couple of minutes of quiet. Coming back over and over again, just to the sensations of being here in the body, in the breath. Noticing the quality of heart today. How is it today? Same with the mind, noticing quality of mind. With an open allowing. Allowing ourselves to be just as we are right in this moment. And as we continue to sit for another minute or two, I'm going to offer you a reflection question as a way to just seed our time together this morning. Are you carrying any burdens or weight? Or is there a habit that if you could let go of today, releasing the burden, releasing the weight, releasing the habit, large or small, what would it be? This is not asking for commentary or judgment, just noticing if there's something that you could release that would support you, and what would that be? And if you could do that, what would it feel like in the body? As if you could do that, how would that reverberate in the body, this letting go? Just notice. And if you can sense any amount of release in the body, in the mind, or heart, just through this reflection question, see if that can spread throughout your body. If you can sense any release, let it fill you. Maybe there's some relaxation, some openness, maybe a little freedom inside. And if not, that's fine too. We're just making the suggestion of possibility, of letting go of anything that is a weight, that isn't supportive. Whatever you noticed, just keep that with you. Just the literal experience of dropping in a question often has a reverberation in the body. And we can use that as a practice all the time. Reflection questions, things that help bring more awareness to the connection between what we think, how we feel, how we are in our lives. How was that for you? Does anybody want to just put your hand up and have something you would like to offer? Yeah, Wadia.
Thank you so much. But when you ask the question, what could I let go, what habit or what feeling, I thought of that. And a smile came to my face. I was immediately, it was instantaneous. So thank you. I'm in tears. Like, thank you so much.
You know, sometimes all we need is the reminder that it's possible to do that. I noticed my shoulders went down. And we need each other for those reminders.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Yeah. One more. Anybody else? I saw a hand at Shannon. Yeah.
Oh, another perfect pronunciation. Well, and I'm echoing the smile, but it felt as if my whole body were smiling.
Ah, beautiful.
Something I've been carrying a long time, that it has tendrils in every area of my life. And usually when I think about getting rid of it, I feel claustrophobic, but this time it's just everything open and smiles all down my arms all the way.
Thanks. I'm so glad. Yeah. So remember that feeling, because when we have the experience and we really take it in the body, smiles in my whole body, it shifts our neurology a little bit. And we can bring that memory back of, oh, that moment that I was able to let go just a little bit. And then it can be supportive later. It becomes a resource. It's really important how these become a resource. All right, thank you. So as I was thinking about what I wanted to share with you today, I just came back from a retreat that I was able to lead in the wilderness. And it was 5 days of being in the mountains, not far from where I live, with it was a women's wilderness hiking and meditation retreat. And it was such a joy to be able to be with people in a safe way. After all of this time that we are living in this separate life of being in our homes during COVID, there was a way in which I think I forgot about just how important and rich it is to be with each other, as Zoom has really become how we communicate. So I was thinking about the practice of retreat and what it does for me. And going back a little bit further, retreat can happen in many, many ways, whether it's a formal, silent, fully silent meditation retreat, or we just take a day to go for a walk, or we're reading a book, any way that we get closer to ourselves so we can reset and have some refuge and renewal and then come back more alive. And I was also reflecting on a retreat that I did last year in which I rented a cabin and I just went by myself. And I downloaded some talks from a retreat, so I created my own kind of retreat, but I was by myself in this cabin, and takes a little more discipline to stay on it by oneself, but with the support of recordings, it was great. And what came out of that retreat were three intentions that I've been working with since then. And I wanted to share that with you and then to talk a little bit more about how that's what I'm really working on in my practice and offer that to you as well. So at the end of that week by myself, I had this thought that I needed to do three things. The first, dissolve contention on any level. Contention with myself, contention with others, contention in general, the experience of arguing with reality. The second one, forgive everyone. No easy task, right? Forgive everyone, including myself. And the third one, wake up. Just wake up to being alive in this life. So I had that thought, and then I thought, my God, that's a tall order. How am I going to do that? How am I going to dissolve contention, forgive everyone, and wake up? I think that as I've been working with this over and over again, is to really understand what it means to let go. Letting go of struggling against anything, cultivating empathy, compassion, kindness for myself and everyone else, a deep level of understanding of how hard we're all working to be healthy and alive and skillful in our lives. And to be fully present. This is what I think about as waking up. Really to be present for our lives exactly as they are. So this takes strength. It takes steadiness. And it takes courage. It's all a practice of letting go, cultivating trust, cultivating compassion. Which is what I want to talk about today and next week. I'll be here next week and we'll flesh this out. So how do we do this? How do I do it? This is how I'm thinking about how do I approach my own practice. And certainly I want to deeply acknowledge that we all have our own ways of approaching this. And these are some offerings, some ways I'm sharing out of my own practice what might be supportive for you as well. So to dissolve contention, first I have to notice all of the ways my patterns of wanting and not wanting cloud my ability to be present. This is this truth of graspiness, of greediness, right? Of just wanting things to be a certain way and pushing things away that aren't the way I want them to be. This is the struggle, right? This is the first and second noble truth, that life includes challenge and we argue with it. First thing, right? Difficulty happens. Second thing, we tend to make it worse because it's our staying in contention with the conditions of our lives. So I don't want to make it worse. You know, this is this piece to dissolve contention. I want to see right in the moment where I have that constriction in my mind or the armoring of my heart that says, I don't want this. And we all do it. Of course we all do it. because life is difficult and struggle is extra. I remember the very first time I heard James Barras say, just remember, struggle is extra. And as soon as I heard that, I thought, oh, wow, it is extra. How can I really notice when I make a difficult thing more difficult and choosing not to? So in thinking about that quality of restraint, of letting go, of simplicity, of that piece of dropping my agenda, just that piece of letting go, I've been reading a book lately called Most Intimate, which is written by Roshi Pat Ankyo O'Hara, a beautiful Zen priest. And this is what she says. True restraint manifests with the vigor of courageous energy. I think this takes courage. True restraint manifests with the vigor of courageous energy. It's not about denial, condemnation, or a rigorous system of do's and don'ts. True restraint is to stop, to notice, to take a breath and ask, who am I? What am I actually doing? Isn't that a great question? What am I actually doing? To stop and pause. There's a great story from Ajahn Chah, who was the teacher of Jack Kornfield, that he was out walking with his monks and nuns somewhere in the Thai forest tradition. And he was pointing out to these different rocks and boulders in a field. And he pointed to a relatively small one and he said, do you think that's heavy? And they said, maybe not so heavy. And then to a slightly larger one, well, do you think that one's heavy? Well, that one maybe looks a little bit heavier. And what about this large one over here? Is this heavy? And they said, oh my God, we could never lift that. It's really heavy. And he said, not if you don't pick it up. None of these are heavy if you don't pick them up. Now, that's not to say we don't take responsibility in our lives. And there are some things that we pick up, that we carry, that we do that are difficult, that are challenging. But this is asking us to know the difference between what's ours and what's not ours. This is the ability to not be in contention with our conditions. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, do not fight with yourself at any level. Do not fight with yourself at any level. Isn't that a fantastic teaching? Can we just let that go? Let's not argue about it. So that's the first one, dissolving contention. And this is just a little preamble before our meditation, and we'll talk more about this on the other side. The second one, forgive everyone. Like, how many grudges do we hold? How are our hearts armored? What are those places that we reject ourselves? You know, forgiving everyone includes us. It's not just about others. And when I talk about forgiveness, I don't talk about it in the typical Judeo-Christian way of thinking about it, because I don't really get it like that. I understand forgiveness from the perspective of deep understanding of ourselves, of our vulnerabilities, of how hard we're all working, and that sometimes we behave in ways that hurts ourselves or others, and can we understand that in each other? So we need the practices of loving kindness, compassion, gratitude, empathy, joy, equanimity. And this is how I relate to that injunction in my practice, forgive everyone. Keep doing the heart practices. Keep developing the heart. And the last one, wake up. Stick with the practice of presence. Every time you understand something a little more deeply, in a way that changes you a little bit, that is a moment of awakening. Sayadaw Utejaniya, who was another very important teacher, he said, you should be happy when you know or understand anything. You should be happy when you know or understand anything. That's that piece of awakening. And the way to stay with this practice of waking up, of dissolving contention, of forgiving everyone, is also what Bhikkhu Bodhi says. Just do two things. Begin and keep going. Begin and keep going. I love that because I can keep going. Even when it's hard, I can come to something small that helps me take the next step. Just take the next step. So this is what I want to explore with us over this week and next week. A two-part series on strength, steadiness, and courage, exploring the practices of renunciation and faith. So this week we'll talk about this letting go and renunciation, and next week we'll talk about faith, the practice of trust and confidence. So now let's move into our meditation. And not to have just given you a bunch of things to think about to stimulate the mind before we meditate, but to offer you support for this letting go, to maybe find these places inside yourself that you can just feel that release, letting go of contention, honoring your own heart, and keep going. So we'll move into the meditation now. And once again, begin by settling in the body, sensing into that places, the place in the body where you're touching whatever you're connected to, perhaps the feet, the backs of the legs, the base of the body. Perhaps your hands are touching themselves, one another, or resting in the lap. Coming into an awareness of touch. Sensing the breath coming and going. And if you can, to the extent that's available to you, approaching our practice today with a warm heart, any amount. Sensing the groundedness of the body being right here. Turning the awareness inward, listening. Listening to whatever arises, just knowing it. Returning over and over again to this moment, this heart. And through the groundedness of the body, being right here, listening and returning. Maybe sensing some trust in the practice. Trusting your awareness, your presence. And landing perhaps in a place of gratitude or appreciation for being here at this moment with all of us, with the support of this Sangha. We'll sit quietly now. When you notice the mind has gone somewhere else, return, sense into the body. Begin again. And choosing where to rest your awareness that works best for you, either in the body, in sensation, or the experience of breathing, the intimate experience of breathing. you choose, and we'll sit. Perhaps bringing back that sense from earlier of letting go. Letting go of anything that is heavy, any kind of burden, anything you don't need right now. Sensing any amount of freedom in the mind or heart or body that arises just from the thought of release. Let that support you. whatever is happening for you in your mind or your heart or the body, holding yourself kindly and gently, knowing that right now it's just like this. If you're especially distracted or perhaps sleepy, get very close to the experience of breathing, the beginning, middle, and end of both the inhale and the exhale, noticing this soft pause before the next breath begins. Or get curious about sensation in the body, energy moving, perhaps tingling or pulsing or vibration. And if you're quite content and at ease and the mind is stable, just know the experience of that. This is what contentment is like. And stay there. Sensing any stillness of mind, softness of heart, settledness of body. Enjoy that. Just this, just in this moment. Now drawing the awareness into the heart center, just sensing into the heart, this whole area of the center of the chest, even the center of the upper back, the side ribs, just sensing into the heart, allowing it to be as it is. Whatever energies of the heart are there today, they belong, part of us. And if you like, imagine breathing into this heart center from every direction, the front and the back of the heart, for sure the back of the heart, above and below, sides and diagonals, drawing fresh breath into the heart center. Energy and aliveness. And then as you breathe out, breathing out back into every direction, allowing the heart to grow a little more spacious, perhaps a little more stable. Increasing its capacity. This breathing in and out of the heart, in and out from every direction. This is the heart's breath. See what this is like for you. See if you can breathe, imagine breathing in into the heart and out of the heart for the next minute or so. This heart's breath is always available to us when we remember this doorway into our natural warmth, friendliness, kindness. I'm going to offer you some compassion phrases today, a way to really hold yourself with kindness and love. Just offering yourself these phrases as a gift of your own generosity for your own well-being. May I accept myself just as I am, right in this moment. However it is for you right now, may I accept myself just as I am, right in this moment. And because we are so human, doing what we can to be okay, may I surround my limitations and challenges with respect, care, and love. May I surround my limitations and challenges with respect, care, and love. And because we need each other, may I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. And trusting and deeply knowing that this path of practice can hold it all, that what we're doing is good and right. May I rest in the beauty and goodness of my awakening heart. May I rest in the beauty and goodness of my awakening heart. Sensing this acceptance, respect, courage, and goodness right here in ourselves, in our hearts and minds, right in this moment. Moving back into the awareness of the whole body now, the mind and heart just as they are. This is a poem from Wu Man Hu Kai, a 12th century Chinese poet. 10,000 flowers in the spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. Welcome back. So just sense into your body and heart right now before we shift and get a little busier. Let it soak. Just let whatever sense of peace or ease, any amount that you feel, let that soak. Okay, so let's take 5 minutes and take a break and come back and I'll offer some more Dharma thoughts and we'll talk with each other as well. So how do we dissolve contention, forgive everyone and wake up? And this is this practice, I think, of letting go of so much and recommitting over and over again to cultivating this presence of mind and this warm heart and not being harsh on ourselves when we're not aware or when we do have ill will or, you know, all the things that trip us up. So I want to talk today about this practice of renunciation. And I know that the word itself can be activating for some of us, that it harkens to some other kinds of practices that might not feel connected to our Buddhist practice, but I think it's actually says exactly what it is. I do love the word renunciation, this practice of restraint, of discipline, of letting go, of simplifying, of really knowing what we need, what we don't need. And I think also my own experience of this time of COVID has shown a light on really what do we need, what do we not need, and not going out as much, and all of these ways that my life feels like it's become a little bit smaller in I'm just not out that much. And so it's really seeing these ways in which that I think I've complicated it, or it's been much busier than it's needed to be. And so this practice of renunciation has been quite lovely. And it is in, from the Buddha's teachings, it's found on a couple of really important lists. One is in the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, of wise intention, the first one being wise view, but the second one, wise intention, includes metta, loving kindness, compassion, and renunciation. That it takes these three components to support our direction, that our direction, our intention, our approach of our lives requires both the metta, the compassion, and the compassion, but also renunciation. That this ability to continually ask ourselves, do I need this? What am I holding on to? What can I release? What is necessary here? What is not necessary here? And the other place that it's found is on the Paramis, the list of 10 perfections of the heart. And renunciation is right there in the beginning, generosity, morality, renunciation, that we have to be able to experience a quality of getting out of our own way. You know, I think that so much of our practice is seeing how we cloud and gunk things up unnecessarily. This place of the Four Noble Truths, do I make it worse? Yeah, things are difficult. I don't have to make it more difficult. That's a choice, and here's how. All of these different practices. So just to remind you again of this piece from Pat Ankyo O'Hara around true restraint. I think this is a meaningful, helpful teaching. True restraint manifests with the vigor of courageous energy. It's not about denial, condemnation, or a rigorous system of do's and don'ts. True restraint is to stop, to notice, to take a breath and ask, what am I actually doing? Now, isn't that one of the gems of what mindfulness practice is? The stopping, the noticing, and choosing. That's the thing that's so beautiful about our practice, is that it trusts us to make wise choices, that we can do that. The Buddha said, I know you can do this. Just find out from yourself, from your own experience, when you pause, when you notice, and you sense into your mind, and to know the state of mind, to feel what's in your heart, whether it's any amount of ill will, any amount of difficult thoughts, it's not to judge that. It's just to know it. That's where we start, is just knowing what is present. What am I actually doing? And it's a powerful practice to know that we have the choice. We do not have to live on automatic, out of that reactivity that causes harm to ourselves and to others, but we can actually take a pause, take a breath, and sense into, I'm frightened right now. Okay, when I'm frightened, where does that take me? Or I'm ecstatic right now. Where does that take me? And this is also not to live on pins and needles and to not live in a stilted way. And this is what happens over time with practice. We get to know ourselves really well. And our choices then become, our wholesome choices then become a default setting. We don't have to work so hard. The more we stick with this practice, we really do trust ourselves. So the path to dissolving what the Buddha taught as the three poisons, greed, ill will, and delusion. Part of the path to doing this is the practice of renunciation. So we really can cultivate non-greed. So a practice of generosity, a practice of enoughness, non-ill will, the warm-heartedness that we just, it just becomes us. It doesn't mean we're not going to have negative thoughts or bad feelings or, you know, difficult feelings towards others or ourselves. It just means we know that. And also to let go of the ways in which we are confused, to see more clearly, this clarity of vision that we get over and over again through studying of the mind. So four kinds of renunciation that I want to offer you today, ways to look at this. The first thing that we look at is, how do we release things, like the ways in which we're caught in material things, stuff, experiences. I was noticing today, I haven't been to many stores, and you know, I've been to the grocery store, and what are my previously normal habits of shopping? Because it's fun, or it feeds something in me to go to a couple of my favorite stores that I think are beautiful, and I just enjoy taking in that. But that is sort of this material consumer default retail therapy response way that might occur in relation to boredom or stress or habit. Can I let go of that? Or when I have the thoughts of experiences, I really do love going places I've never been. Well, what if I just explored more right where I live? you know, really sinking into what is right here. Can I let go of those kinds of things and know what is enough? This practice is about knowing enough is enough. How do we experience that quality of being satiated, either not just food, I'm just in our lives? And I think that we all have different experiences of when we do feel enough, when we do feel satisfied. What is our conditioning and our upbringing around prosperity and scarcity? Are we afraid of not having enough to eat or not having shelter? This is a big deal. Not having access to healthcare, not having loved ones, a welcoming community, that's frightening. And that can be, cause us to behave in ways that we're holding on to life with a very tight grip, because if we let go, we might die. You know, we might not have enough security. So I want to be very careful in talking about how we can let go, to acknowledge that we all come from different places on this continuum line of how we experience prosperity and scarcity and how it influences our ability to feel free in ourselves, this quality of letting go. But there is a way in which we can talk about it that I think does apply to many of us, which is that oftentimes the thing we desire, whether it's a material thing or an experience, whatever the thing is that we desire, the thing is not the problem. It isn't about what it is we want. It's our relationship to the desire itself that keeps us stuck. It's that, you know, that urge of, I just want a chocolate chip cookie. I can't get it out of my mind. I just want a chocolate chip cookie. Well, the cookie isn't the problem. It's just a cookie. But it's being caught in the wanting of it. And Sylvia has a wonderful way of describing this in her book, Pay Attention for Goodness Sake, which is all about the paramis. What she says is, I need to keep discovering that the pain of the struggle is greater than the pain of desire. If I develop the habit of restraining myself, I'll enjoy the relief of feeling desires pass, and I'll remember that desires are not the problem. Feeling pushed around by them is. So this is an important piece that applies to all of us, I think, maybe regardless, maybe not, but I do, I was going to say regardless of where we are on that prosperity, scarcity continuum, we can feel the ways that we are hijacked by our desires. And that's the piece we want to look at. We don't want to be, you know, held captive by that. We want to have the freedom of heart and mind to say, I don't need that right now. And it doesn't have to hold me so tightly. Lao Tzu said, one who knows that enough is enough will always have enough. One who knows that enough is enough will always have enough. But it's a big practice. And I want you to really hear from me in this, that I don't think any of this is easy. I'm offering you these practices as practices, and I don't have it worked out either. We're not going to finish this class today and say, oh, I got that renunciation thing down. No way. This is ongoing. We do this together. One way that I think is a lot of fun, that I find very challenging to work with the experience of feeling satisfied, is a practice called Five Bites from Full. Anybody know it? Just wave. It's really kind of fun. I know some of you know it. It's really wonderful. And we can use it in the context of eating, but we can also use it in the context of anything else. But here's the practice. When you sit down to eat and you pick up your fork or your whatever utensil it is that you're eating with, and you take a bite, put the utensil down and just chew your food, taste it, notice it, swallow it, and don't pick your utensil up to take another bite until you've completely swallowed that bite. And then do it again and put your utensil down. And the thing about this is the mind is so distractible that it's really hard to do it. But if we do it, we will notice when we're satisfied. We will tend not to overeat because we will be dialed into the sensitivity of feeling that sense of fullness, but not eating in a mindless way that you go, oh my God, I ate so much, I didn't even taste it. I can only do this for about 2 or 3 bites before I forget what I'm doing. This is not an easy practice, but we can apply it to anything. How many pairs of wool socks do I need? You know, like all of these ways in which you get a pair of this, I'm speaking for myself, I get a pair of really great socks and I think I need more than one. Why do I need more than one? So can I notice that? So this is this practice of letting things go and knowing what is enough. The second piece of renunciation, I think these get harder in order here, is people, relationships, expectations of these different, how we are in relationship with people, how we want others to be, how we want others to be in relationship with us, how we are with ourselves. So if you've ever had the experience of a friendship that maybe dissolves over time and you can't figure out why, it's painful. Or do we hold on to a friendship because we've known this person for 30 years and it should just be the way it always was? But then we recognize that perhaps both of us have changed or one of us really needs something different. Can we let them go? With love, can we say, yeah, right, you're dear to me and our friendship isn't what it was and it needs to be different. Can we let go? That's been hard for me. I remember one particular friendship that I'm thinking about. My son said to me not long ago, Mom, that was 30 years ago. You're basing this on something that doesn't exist anymore. And it was a wake-up call because we get that way. Or I'm a very loyal person. And I know I was holding on too tightly to what couldn't be. And so what is that gift that we give when we can let go of others? Or when we can ask to be let go from others, to be able to have the courage to say, I can't meet your needs. Painful, right? This is not easy to do this. But when we hold on to anything too tightly, and because we know without a doubt that everything changes and is always changing, if we hold on to it like this and it's changing, we get rope burn, right? That's what happens. That metaphor of rope burn is really good because it stings and it's painful. So we have to open up. We have to widen it out so we can all breathe. The third aspect of renunciation, letting go of views, right? Opinions, limiting belief systems. Wow. You know, look where we are now. In our country, in this political climate, and what is happening with all of our opinions and our abilities or inabilities to listen to one another. This is a big deal. Fixed views. Are our views based on what is currently happening, or are they based on old experiences? Are we projecting onto a current situation belief systems from a previous time that have nothing to do with what's actually happening? That's the judgmental mind. But are they coming, do we have belief systems that are harmful to ourselves or others? Are they coming from ill will? What are our intentions? What are our conditioned beliefs? And this is the part of courageous practice that I'm pointing to here, is that it takes a lot of courage to question ourselves, to say, what am I thinking? Why do I think this? What am I doing? Why am I doing it? Is it based on fear? Is it based on what? Deeply held values. And you know, we do have views that shape our lives that are very important. So I'm not talking about wholesome views here. You know, I'm really not talking about the view and the opinions around understanding the importance of equity, diversity, inclusion, racial and environmental justice, all of these things. I'm not talking about that those are a problem, because those are rooted in wholesome intent. I'm talking about the views and the belief systems and the value systems that actually cause harm to ourselves or others. So here's an example. Needing to be right. Right? What is it like to be right? So for right now, and I want to ask for some feedback, imagine that feeling in the body. What does it feel like to be right? Literally. And just maybe raise your hand a couple of people and describe what you feel in your body when you know you're right. Okay, Suzanne.
So I feel stiff and rigid and when I'm right. You know, just like inflexible.
Yeah, exactly. Stiff and rigid and inflexible. I love that. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay, Adrian.
I feel aggressive.
Uh-huh, aggressive.
And it's taken me a while to realize that. Because when I'm, you know, when I'm right, I'm really right. And now I realize that's why people maybe get angry with me, you know, even if I'm right, they get angry. And I wish I had figured that out long ago.
Oh well. I mean, don't we all have a lot of those? Yeah. Okay. Aggressive. Good. How about Heidi?
So I reflect with the other people. I feel like I mean, there are very few times when I feel this way, but with the CDC, okay, I know that they're making mistakes. They made mistakes about masks. They have made recent mistakes about things. And there's no room, it almost feels like there's no room for anything different to occur in some ways for me. I feel so angry, and I feel that they're doing harm, and that if they just had the right view. So very much feeling like I'm the victor somehow, but there isn't any room for discussion. And it really ignites me.
Yeah. So how does that feel in your body to be ignited?
Like I need to run or something.
Okay. That's great. Exactly. That needing to run. I get that. Perfect. Thank you. All right. Looks like a couple other people with a hand up.
Sonia.
When I feel like I am right, I have a very strong sense of being superior, of being better than the other person. And I do the other. I separate myself.
Yes, yes.
I see them as, okay, they're there. They're not, you know, I have it. It's almost like I can't find the common ground and the humanity. I lose a sense of humanity with the other person. That's
such a beautiful awareness. Yes. Do you feel it in your body?
Totally. My heart, it feels like I close my heart to their point of view because they're wrong.
Wrong. So there's an armoring. There's an armoring, it sounds like.
And I'm right and they're wrong. So therefore, they're not in my heart anymore, kind of thing.
Thank you. Last one.
Hi. I'm definitely recognizing what everyone is saying. But when you first posed the question, there was a different kind of being right that came to my mind with a completely different physical reaction. So an example is, I have a very poor sense of direction. And if I get in the and I have to go somewhere and I wonder what to do, and I do it right, it's a joyful thing. So sometimes personal rightness is really great. I mean, it's like a really fun treat. Just this morning, I had to go somewhere and I took a different route and I was right.
So I want to point out something, Patricia, that's so beautiful about that. That is an aspect of joy. And this is not the aspect of the righteousness that keeps us stuck. So earlier in the talk, I said that piece from Sayadaw Utejaniya, who says, you should be happy when you know or understand anything. That is joy. And so that sense of, oh my God, I found my way. Yes, and we want to take that in too. And so the skill here is being able to discern the difference, right? This is the kind of awareness that opens us versus the kind of righteousness that closes us, that goes to what Sonia said about othering, you know, cutting ourselves off. So I'm so glad you brought that in, because that's an important distinction. Okay, thank you. Now, the other side of this question, what does it feel like to be wrong? What does it feel like to be wrong? Now just bring that in. Notice it in your body. And who would like to say what that feels like? Barbara, and then Nancy.
When I'm wrong, and it's usually after I have experienced what Sonia just talked about, that I was right, and then it hits me that I'm not, a quality of shame comes up.
Oh, yeah. And how does it feel in the body?
Awful. Sad. Mm-hmm. Old.
Is there a physical feeling with that that you can name?
Maybe a numbness.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
And it's usually, especially if it's on the other side of the holier and thou, feeling that I was right, or something that I've clung to so, the rightness so strongly. And then it hits me that, wow, I was like completely off base.
Yeah.
Then a whole flood of different
feelings
come. Negative.
You know what's so beautiful about that is that there's a parallel, that in that moment of the wider awareness, it is similar to when we sit in meditation and we know that the mind has gone somewhere else, and we know it, and right in that moment, it's a moment of pure awareness and we come back. So right in that moment of, oh, right, that wasn't right, there's so much that opens up, even in when it's painful. So it's important to note those times.
Thank you.
Nancy.
For me, being wrong is equated with making a mistake. Mm-hmm. And mistakes are intolerable to me. It is something that I find myself, can I turn back the clock? Can I undo this? I do not want it to have happened. And the physical manifestation is in a constriction in my breathing, mm-hmm. and I need to get out of here. I need to escape because this situation is just, and then, you know, I understand where the conditioning of this comes from. But still, it's one of the more challenging experiences that I have.
It's a very challenging experience because the conditioning says we're supposed to be right and not supposed to be wrong.
Right.
And we're conditioned to have shame around it. And instead of approaching it, I mean, you know, where do we learn? We don't learn when we're rigid and right. We learn when we're soft. And we literally that softness and our practice, hopefully, there's enough self-compassion in our practice that allows us to learn and to say, I blew it. Yeah. And not have to flee, mm-hmm. not have to flee. But that's the conditioning because we have so many messages about being right and not being wrong and that there's something wrong with being wrong. Yeah. And it's not, it's not. I mean, that ability to say, wow, what do I not see here? What am I not seeing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Nancy. Mickey, did you have something? So good to see you.
Oh, and you. Always happy when I see you. No, I forgot what I was going to say. I was too happy. Anyway, so I agree with the first person, and I've forgotten her name, that sense of shame.
Barbara.
What happens with me is that I feel this kind of caving in my torso and around it, like I'm gonna, that sense of shame and also protecting myself.
Yeah.
And for me, it leads to, and this is, we're talking about conditioning a minute ago, the conditioning of I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
Exactly. In trouble.
Thank you so much for naming this. So that piece of caving in the chest and at the same time protecting ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's so important, isn't it? That we learn proper boundaries so we can be wrong. So we have enough grounding and care for ourselves that it's not a personal threat to not know. Yeah, keep going.
I will say in the past few years, I found more of a voice and my husband and I have been in conversations where I can finally go, oh, yeah. And stay there instead of like, you know,
exactly. We don't have to
know that I'm wrong, but I'm not going to admit it, or I'm not going to say, well, of course, or.
Yeah. But what a gift, you know, if we go back to how we are with other people, what a gift we give to one another when we can say, oh yeah, I'm glad you could bring that in. And what you said, I can stay. You don't have to go.
Yeah.
And one more.
Another conversation comes.
Exactly. All the options, so many things open up when we let go of people of the views and opinions that keep us separate, that keep us blocked off. One more, Jane.
First, it's great to see everyone. But to your question to us, what I feel when I'm wrong is, I don't know if it's a societal thing or how I was brought up, but if I was wrong, I feel like I failed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like life is a test. And so it was a test. And if I don't have the right answer, or if I don't know the right thing, then it means I failed. Yeah. And so that's kind of a crummy feeling, of course, and that's why I think it's hard to accept those things.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And that feeling of failure is such a conditioned response. Mm-hmm. And we need our practices of metta, of self-love and compassion, to counteract that right in the moment, to say, whoa, 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 that's just not true. That was just a moment of not knowing, you know, of just not knowing. And caring for ourselves in that. You know, there's the beautiful injunction that says, from many Buddhist texts, that says, oh, nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember the luminous nature of your mind. Remember the goodness of your heart. It is your home. Trust it. And that's the peace in this, to remember we are good, whether we get the right answer or not, or who knows what's right and who's wrong, but to show up with this big-heartedness, with the ability to not know. You know, all the Zen teaching, always keep don't know mind. Always keep don't know mind. To pause, to check in with ourselves, not be so sure, and be willing to ask. And this is a renunciation practice of letting go of views, letting go of this tightness, feeling threatened when we're opposed, right? So we've all, there's been a lot of discussion or pointing to the sense of threat when our views aren't shared or our views are questioned. The Buddha said, those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. Isn't that great? Those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. So what would it be like, just as, you know, in the next week before we see each other again, just to notice the opinions, notice and ask yourself, huh, is that true? Nobody has to know it. You know, you don't have to feel shame or any of that. Just, huh, I wonder if that's actually accurate. You might find out it is, or that it really works in your value system. But just the capacity to question it, to reflect on it, opens us up. There's so many places in our teachings that say that. In the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. That means we get off of the ways that we keep experiencing suffering and getting tripped up. By not holding to fixed views, we are freed. Check that out for yourself in your own practice. Notice your fixed views. We all have them. I have them. For sure I have them. I just need to notice which ones support my well-being and which ones do not. And are we willing to look at, oh, that actually really isn't good for me, that view? And then to have the courage to shift it. From the third Zen patriarch, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Oh, come on. No preferences? The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Now, my understanding of this, the way I relate to that, is that it's not that we don't have preferences, but we are not hijacked by them. That we have the capacity to say, I really like it like this, and I don't like it like that, and I can manage. This is where our resiliency comes in. This is where the equanimity comes in that says, right now it's like this. I may really prefer it to be like that, but it isn't. And so how can I be okay even within this? How can I find that sense of balance? Because when we do, when we let go of the right and wrong, and we can just be with things with a little more ease, we are really present. We're right there in the moment, present for our lives. This is how it is. I want to read you a poem. This is from Lynn Unger, lovely poet, a poem called The Way It Is. One morning you might wake up to realize that the knot in your stomach has loosened itself and slipped away, and that the pit of unfilled longing in your heart had gradually, and without your really noticing, been filled in, patched like a pothole, not quite the same as it was, but good enough. And in that moment, it might occur to you that your life, though not the way you planned it, and maybe not even entirely the way you wanted it, is nonetheless persistently, abundantly, miraculously, exactly what it is. Can we do that? To know that our lives are exactly as they are, and maybe even good enough. Maybe even good enough. And this takes a letting go, right? A release, a renunciation of how we think our lives should be, our idea about our lives, but actually being in them. This is this practice. The fourth piece of renunciation is watching how we are controlled by fears. Fears about the future, fears about anything. How are we limited by, oh my God, this thing might happen, so I better not do this. So we can give up our own agency based on fear, and we need to watch that. My husband doesn't like it when I do X, and if I do that thing, he may get annoyed with me. So I'm not going to do that thing that I really like to do because I don't want his annoyance. Well, is that thing that I love something that's really important? And maybe we're talking about making peach pie. I mean, I am not talking about enormous things. I want to make a peach pie because it's summer. It's coming to the end of summer, and summer isn't complete without a peach pie, but he doesn't want me to make it because it's got too many carbs in it. Well, if I don't make that peach pie, I'm not going to have that piece, that thing that it just brings me so much joy. He doesn't have to eat it, right? The fear of that. I'm talking about a minor thing here, and I'm doing that on purpose because that's actually a conversation we had yesterday when I said, I'm going to make a peach pie. And he said, oh, there's so many carbs. I said, but I want to make a peach pie. I made it, and we might not finish it, but I didn't want to be stuck in, oh God, he doesn't want me to do it for fear of him being upset because he might eat too much, you know, whatever. That's just a really minor example. But how do those kinds of, you know, fears that keep us from the fullness of our lives, to watch that, to really watch that? And one of the ways to be a little more serious on this, when we commit to our ethical lives, to truly the practices of non-harming ourselves or one another, there's a certain amount of fear that is released because we know that our lives are in line with the values of wholesomeness and non-harming and kindness and wisdom. Right there in that commitment to these kinds of practices, we're more willing to try, we're more willing to fail when we are aligned with goodness. Like when we know that we are not going to harm another intentionally, because we are committed to not doing that through our language, through our behavior, all of these precepts around non-harming, but actually committed to supporting other people, towards practices of generosity, towards kind speech, towards caring for our bodies and the bodies of others, not consuming too much so we don't get foggy vision, foggy mind. When we're really committed, we don't need to be as afraid because we are solid in ourselves. And it affects others when we commit to our ethical conduct. we become a zone of safety for others, so others don't need to be afraid of us. So this is a way of releasing fear. We can trust a little bit more. And this is what I wanted to offer you today around dissolving contention, forgiving others, waking up. Ajahn Chah says, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you can let go completely, you will have complete peace. That's our practice. That is our practice. So we have a few minutes to talk with each other about anything, any questions at all.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a little granddaughter, and when she was like 4 or 5, I asked her the question. I said, and I've been a nurse in critical care for years, I'm retired now, but I've seen the imperfection of my decisions and made many wrong decisions and the stress of that. And so I asked her this question, you know, like I said around 4, I said, are you perfect? And she was really cute. She thought for a minute and she goes, of course I'm perfect.
Oh.
We kind of led on that, kind of like what you've been talking about, but she was at a young age. Well, the same question came up. Now she's a teenager. She's 14. And she saw it in a different way. You know, we talked about this perfection that we all hold on to. And I actually felt now that she got this incredible stress that comes in life of this perfectionism, which we all carry around. Like you said, the pie. Should I make the little G? You know, maybe I won't make the pie because I want to please him. So it's something I think that goes way back.
Yeah, I think it does.
If we can just have the gift. I wish I would have had somebody kind of ask me some of the questions that you put forth when I was little in a non-judgmental, safe way.
Yeah, thank you. You know, the thing about perfection is that it doesn't exist. Like, what is perfect anyway? And there's the freedom of just getting rid of that. There's another piece in the Verses of the Faith Mind, which is from the Third Zen Patriarch, that says, to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Can we be without anxiety about non-perfection? I hope so. I hope so. Our perfectly imperfect selves, right? That's another way of describing dukkha. Is this the pain of imperfect? It's just imperfect. This is just true. That perfect is non-existent in this exalted way. Thank you, Maureen. Nancy.
I'm embarrassed to say that it took me almost 70 years to come to the realization that not everybody shares my opinions. It isn't quite right or wrong, but it's just that if I have an idea about what's the best way to do something, of course everybody else should agree with it. And where this realization has helped me most is in my day-to-day relationships with people, especially my husband. Because, you know, cohabiting with somebody, there are everyday examples of how, you know, when should we eat? What should we eat? How, you know, should we remodel the bathroom? I mean, some big things and some small things. And just knowing that my opinion is not the only one has given me much more space to evaluate, do I really care that much about this issue? Can I just let him go? And so things are different around our house. He has this creative, wild, creative side. And so, you know, little art installations are popping up around our yard and stuff. And it's not exactly something I would do, but it's something that's important to him. And it's okay for me to let it go because his opinion is equally valid.
And that comes under forgive everybody, right? This is about acknowledge, accepting, allowing us to be who we are. Mm-hmm. Because we do tend to, like, I love what you said. I couldn't believe everybody didn't share my opinion. Yeah. How is that possible? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anybody else? We have time for one more. Looks like Casey, maybe?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Thank you. I've really, what's kind of still creeping in my mind is what you were mentioning earlier that you're not talking about. You're not talking about social justice issues. You're not talking about those. But, and where I struggle is where those things were, like, sometimes they, there's a lot of fear and fixation on there being change or there needing to be.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, and for me, that tends to devolve mm-hmm. into like constricted beliefs about things.
Yeah.
But it's confusing because it feels rooted in something that's about love and about protecting and about, so I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's such an important point. So what I meant when I said I'm really not addressing those huge systemic issues, I really hope that nobody heard it as a dismissal of those issues. I was trying to draw the distinction of just what we are doing in our own hearts. Because when we change ourselves, we have more resiliency and capacity to engage in those, in these crises that we are all in. So in no way was I dismissing that. I was wanting to draw the distinction of that's a different level of work around renunciation, but it starts with right here. Because I don't think that we really can effectively work in those bigger arenas with a clear mind and really being connected to our intentions until we recognize how our own views and opinions, our fears, our expectations, what we want, how that affects us personally, because my hunch is that we have so much commonality with people. You know, we all feel so much pain for different reasons and also love for different reasons. And this is the piece of when we see our common humanity and we do our own work around seeing how we are both caught and free in different places in our lives, it enables us to work on those bigger issues with less reactivity. Does that make sense? Am I answering your question? Yeah. So I really want everybody to know I was not dismissing these bigger issues. What I was coming to is let's first work on our own relationship to ourselves in these realms so we have more resiliency and more capacity to move out into the crises that we're all living in. Thank you so much for bringing that up. It's really important. So it is noon, 1 minute past, and I'm very, very grateful to all of you who shared practice today. And I love having these discussions and being able to talk with each other throughout our time together. It's a rich experience, and we need each other to do this. So thank you everybody. I hope you'll come back next week for part two of how do we do all of these practices, the faith, the confidence, and the trust we need to go forward. All right. Have a wonderful week. Be safe. Be well. Love yourselves.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.